Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Sunday, December 29th. Welcome back to another edition of Technology for Blind People podcast. Today we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to interview a friend of mine, a mentor, a person who has showed me the ropes throughout my middle school when I was transitioning from middle school to high school. And he showed me the ropes. He showed me how to get around and showed me how to, not be afraid of going in, public vehicles and things like that. I'm your host, Joseph Hernandez. Welcome back. Today we're going to interview a mentor, a friend of mine now, named Steve Bauer. Steve, thank you for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it. Thank you for lending me a few hours of your time.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm going to enjoy it, I'm sure.
I would like to know, Steve, how did you, for those who don't know, Steve got started in radio. He was a disc jockey up in Santa Barbara, and then he moved down here and he met his wife, Kathy, who's deceased. She passed away, what would you say, about a few months ago or a month ago,
Yeah,
something like
September
that?
26th, so almost, I guess a little over 3 months now.
She was a wonderful person and they made a very, very good couple together. What I would like to know, Steve, is, well, start off from how you got into radio, what interested you, and what made you say, I'm going to get into it and this is what I'm going to do. And then, what made you say, you know what, radio's not for me. I want to try something different. I want to try, teaching. And, just we'll go from there. Why don't you tell us how you got started in radio?
Okay, well, like a lot of kids, more so when I was a kid than it is nowadays, because we didn't have YouTube or the internet or whatever, but I loved to listen to the radio, and music was something I really loved, like all teenagers, and I just decided that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be one of those guys on the radio. Had a couple of friends in high school that felt the same way, and we used to hang around couple of different radio stations. We'd bug people and usually get turned away, but a couple of people let us kind of come in and learn how to run the board and how things are running in radio. But when I got connected up with rehab, they told me that really they didn't think radio was a good career for a blind person. And I had heard, just reading magazine articles of blind folks that worked in radio, tried to write some letters to them and get to know them and never got in contact with anybody. This, of course, is long before the internet and everything. So when I got into college, I decided, okay, I'm going to go ahead. Another thing I really enjoyed was teaching. I'd done some tutoring and stuff in high school, so I went to UC Santa Barbara with the idea of becoming a teacher. And as the years progressed, I decided I wanted to teach Braille to other blind kids. Thought that really Braille was something that was underutilized, and so that was my plan. And guess about the third year in college, I decided, okay, there's a campus radio station here, so I'm going to just go play around. It's not going to be a career, but I'll get it out of my blood and see what it's like to actually be on the radio. So I started off in the newsroom working, and then ended up having a DJ show. Started off with 2 to 6 a.m. and then progressed up to doing afternoons. And long story short, over a couple of years, I ended up becoming the training director at the campus radio station, KCSB, and then the production director, and really kind of got this in my blood. And some friends at the station were getting jobs at local radio stations, and so I thought I would try that. In the meantime, I had gotten accepted up at San Francisco State, was going to go up to school up there, and had a little minor conflict with rehab as to whether they're going to pay for grad school or not. And so I decided, okay, maybe I'll try and get a job in radio and do that for a couple of years and save some money and then pay for school myself. Well, I got an entry-level job at a beautiful music station, KRUZ, and then that led to another entry-level job at KDB. And I started out there doing midnight to six and ended up staying with the company for over 10 years. doing various different things. They had an all-news station on the AM. I worked at that for a while. They did classical music on the FM. I worked there, ended up doing mornings there. Left there in 1992 and went to work for KMGQ, which was a adult contemporary station. That transitioned into, they started doing a smooth jazz show in the evening and doing adult contemporary in the daytime, and I got the job as hosting that evening show. In 97, the station, it was doing so well, they decided to make it 24 hours a day for smooth jazz, and I was by then the music director, so that was a lot of fun. And it was great. It was owned by a couple of different owners, and one thing that I always said was, gee, I'm getting tired of working for these mom-and-pop organizations. I want to work for a real radio company. Well, in 1999, I got my wish, and KMGQ was bought by Cumulus Media, which was the second largest behind Third Channel owner of radio stations in this country. And I soon learned to be very careful what you wish for, because working for a big media company was not at all fun. I was used to having a lot of freedom, being able to play what music I wanted to on the air. My bosses were very supportive of me. As long as the ratings were decent, then they didn't really care what I did. And when I went to work for Cumulus, as I've told a lot of people, literally, I mean, everything I did, I had to get permission from Atlanta, and it became a real drag. And so I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I gave some more thought to perhaps going into teaching and stuff and doing various different things. As Joseph said, I met Kathy, and we had a commuter relationship. I lived in Santa Barbara. She lived in Culver City, and that went on for several years, and I was kind of half-heartedly looking for a job in L.A. And then in 2003, Cumulus went through a reorganization, and I was downsized, which is a nice way of saying that they were going to do with less people, and I was one of the people they could do without. So I was unemployed, and so I moved in with Kathy in Culver City and started looking for a job down here, and started volunteering at Junior Blind of America, taking some computer classes at the Metropolitan Skills Center and the Regional Occupation Program. The Junior Blind volunteer opportunity led to a job for about a year, and then it was a part-time job, and then I found out about the Braille teaching job at Braille Institute Anaheim, applied for that job, and was hired in September 2004, and I've been there ever since. That's probably more of a long, rambling reply than you wanted, but that answered your question.
Oh, no, that's fine. I want to go back a little bit, and I want to talk about how it was, or what was it that made you say, I want to work for a regular, a real radio company? Was it because the radio station that you were working for was very small? Was it because they were not, you know, very big and you wanted to try something bigger? What made the light go on and say, you know what, I want to work for the second largest radio company?
Well, I didn't specifically want to work for the second largest company, but I guess I always had this thing of, you know, often when you're young, the grass is often greener on the other side, and I just figured if I could find a bigger company to work for, that maybe I could move to a bigger market. I had dreams of getting a job in Los Angeles or somewhere else, and a lot of my friends who were in radio at the time were getting jobs, but you always started off on doing the overnight shift, and friends of mine would drive down from LA or drive down from Santa Barbara, do an air shift in LA, and drive home. Well, that obviously wasn't a possibility for me, because if I went to LA, it was on the Greyhound, not being able to drive. So I'm not really sure why I felt that. I guess it was just like grass is always greener, and I was happy, and I was making a little bit of money. I mean, Santa Barbara is a small market, and radio wages are based on the amount of advertising, which is in turn based on the size of the market. So I wasn't making Rick D's type wages in Santa Barbara, and never would. And so I was just looking for some way to better my situation, I guess, not really being very aware of what I was wishing for. So I guess that's the answer to the question. But looking back now, I had it pretty good, and looking back on, especially nowadays, what some folks are doing with consultants, and just the freedom I had, and I love music, and it was just a joy to be able to you know, grab the new CDs that came in the mail every day and listen to them and with my colleagues and say, gee, this is junk, you know, this is great, let's play this track, and that was just a wonderful thing, and I guess I didn't know how good I had it.
Now, I want to talk about, since this is the Technology for Blind People podcast, I want to talk about how the radio stations allowed you to use technology such as JAWS or Window Eyes, or, you know, if they allowed you to use any technology at all, or was it a pain to try and, did you have to fight with them is what I'm trying to say, in order for them to allow you to use technology on their computer systems, or did you have to bring your own technology into work just so you can, you know, provide music on the air and things like that?
Well, when I started out, I got my first paying job in 1978, there was no JAWS, and there was very little technology as far as computers in radio stations. I was playing records, and we had these little carts. If you've ever seen an 8-track tape, the carts were shaped kind of like that, except they weren't 8-tracks, they were just a stereo cartridge with maybe 70 seconds of tape inside, and that was all the commercials were played on, these little cartridges. So I guess my technology was a Perkins Thriller to write down all of the commercials and public services promotions that I had to read.
Boy,
and
those then, Perkins Thrillers were, boy, those, I don't mean to cut you off, boy, those Perkins Brothers, you talk about them. I can remember lugging them when I was in middle school. That's how I did my math. I can remember, you know, taking them from the resource room to the classroom and then taking them back to the resource room way across campus, and, you know, it was a pain. They're not light at all, ladies and gentlemen. You know, you guys are a new generation. You guys think, oh, Perkins Brothers, those things, those were light. Oh, no, they're nothing compared to Braille Notes or Braille Lights or you know, Pac-Mates or anything like that. You guys have no idea of how it was to carry a Perkins Brother, use your white cane, have Braille paper, and your backpack in your hand, and try not to hit any poles, any people, anything like that. I'm sure Steve can attest to that as well.
Yeah, very much so. I actually had a large backpack that I could carry, like you say, a Perkins and some extra paper and whatever else I needed to have, my headphones. And I was very fortunate. My parents bought me a Perkins Brailler when I was a young child, and they bought me another one when I was in college, specifically so I could leave a Brailler at the radio station and a Brailler at home, and then I got Rehab to buy me a third one, actually, and I kept one in the library. So I was fortunate that I had three machines that I was able to leave at different places. So, and then at one point when I was out of school and I was at one point working at two radio stations at the same time, I had a Brailler at one station, at both stations, and one at home. But yeah, they're a half, leaving the carry from room to room. Anyway, so yeah, that was the technology. It was the Perkins Brailler. I had a Dymo labeler that I made Braille Dymo labels for the carts and for the albums. And then, of course, we transitioned from albums to CDs in the 80s and started labeling all the CDs. And the first computer system I had to deal with was when I, partially through my time at KMGQ, they brought in a computer system to play all the music, that we'd record the music as audio files, the spots as audio files, and everything would be played off a computer. And that's when things got kind of scary. And they brought in the computer system. It was a program called Digital Scott Studios. And I asked if I could bring in my copy of Window Eyes and load it on the machine. Actually, it was Vocal Eyes, which is the DOS version of Window Eyes. And people were very hesitant about running software they didn't understand on their computers, but they let me do it. And it didn't work well at all. The screen was so busy, it was so very difficult to find things on the screen that I didn't know if I'd ever be able to use it. And luckily, I had a good friend of mine from college who was a computer programmer, and he came up and tackled the challenge and wrote what we used to call set files, are now called, you know, scripts for JAWS or apps, whatever, but basically programs to tell the screen reader what to read when. So he set up a lot of hotkeys for me. So if I wanted to read the next song, I could do one, had a hotkey, the previous song, the last hours were the songs. song showed up on the screen as color-coded, and so he wrote in the script. So the screen reader would say, already played, now playing, playing next, you know, that sort of thing. And also, I should backtrack a little bit, actually. I skipped something very important. Back in the 80s, when I worked at KDB, before they had computers, I mentioned they were an all-news station. And when I first started there, I was just reading local news, and the other folks that worked in the newsroom would read their stories to me onto a cassette tape, and I would transcribe them with the Perkins Brailler. Well, my buddy Joe wrote me a program that would actually turn print into Braille, and I bought a Apple computer to run that program on, the old Apple IIe, and also bought a Braille embosser. And he also set it up so that I could use this program to translate UPI copy from United Press International, the wire service. And so things would come over the wire and get printed out on the machine in the studio. And then they would also go to my computer, and I could get Braille printouts of the news from UPI. So that was really my first major use of technology, starting in 1980. And then going over to KMGQ, actually playing the music off of the computers in the late 90s. Finally ran into a chief engineer. We went through several chief engineers, and the guy that they hired, I guess in 98 or 99, was very, very supportive, and he understood what screen readers were all about, and he was very supportive, even to the point that when they came out with a new version of the software, many of your listeners know we dread when new versions of software come out, because are they going to work with our screen readers? And so he would actually, before he loaded the new version of the Digital Scott Studios, he would come and check and make sure it worked with my screen reader before he loaded it on the program. And if it didn't, then we'd call Joe and say, Joe, help, we need some help with making this work. And you know, thank God for my good friend Joe. I don't know how I could have done it without that. So then, you know, what's the technology I used? And I didn't have a Braille note yet. I didn't get that until after I left radio. That would have been very helpful, but everything that I wrote had to be written, sent into the computer to print out on the Braille embosser, or for just short things, I would continue to write them on the Perkins Brailler, and that was the technology I used. And of course, made the transition from DOS to Windows, so I went from Vocalize to Windowize. When we changed to Windows, we ended up with a program called the Audio Wizard by Prophet Systems, which some of your listeners may have heard of. It's used to be owned by Clear Channel. They're now, once again, an independent company. And when those guys came out, they were very hesitant, and they flat out said, as we were trying to hook everything up and the screen reader work, that you know, this system was never intended for a blind person. It's a very busy screen. We can't make this work. And thank God the chief engineer, good old John Strawler, said, you know, he's our music director. We've got to make this work. And I was very, very lucky, because easily, if I had had management or an engineer who didn't really care that I was working there or not, just said, this is too much of a hassle, go find a sighted guy, then I could have very easily been out of my ears. So I guess I would say to any of your listeners, if you're going to work in radio, I found out that it's very, very important to have a good friend and the chief engineer, because he can make or break your experience at working in a radio station.
Now, I want to ask you about, you know, coming to LA, and how was the transition? Was it, you know, was it something that you said, I'm done with radio, I'm out of here, I'm done with it? Or when you came to LA, did you still want to try to pursue radio? Or, you know, what made you say, you know what, I want to try something different, you know, I want to, you know, I'm talking to this person, I want to, you know, be closer to her. What made you say, you know, radio's done for me, I'm done?
Well, I don't think it was a single event, Joseph. It was just a combination of things. I realized once that Cumulus took over the radio station in the early 2000s that it wasn't as much fun as it used to be. I wasn't going to get any raises. Getting a job in LA, if it was difficult in the 80s and 90s, it was almost impossible in the 2000s. When I met Kathy, I saw a figure quoted to me in, I think, 2002, that something like 40% of the people that had worked in radio in Los Angeles 5 years ago were unemployed. And this is because computers required less people. I mean, you know, when you're working in LA, you might be on the air in LA, and then you can do what they call voice track, which is record, you know, your DJ commentary and stuff for other radio stations. And maybe you can be on the air on two different stations, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. And while you're doing your live morning show, you record your afternoon show for another radio station. So there were a lot less people. So I knew it was going to be very, very difficult to work in radio in LA. I also knew that I had a lot of experience, and I had no experience at all teaching. So I wasn't sure what the heck I was going to do. When I got, you know, I was looking for a job in various different fields in LA, and then when I got downsized and actually moved down here and began looking in earnest, okay, I can't mess around anymore, I got to find a job. I actually had at one point, I think, four or five different resumes out there. I had a radio resume, I had a teaching resume, I had a Braille teaching resume, I had a resume for looking for customer service type work that just emphasized my people skills. I had a resume for doing dispatch work, police and fire. I've never actually done professional dispatch work, but I've been a ham radio operator most of my life, and I've done a lot of volunteer work for different agencies and worked alongside dispatchers and stuff, so I've got a little bit of knowledge of that. So, and I didn't know what the heck I wanted to be honest with you. I applied for lots of jobs. I applied for a number of different radio stations and went on a couple of interviews and had a couple of friends that worked in radio down here that tried to get me in, and nothing happened. And like I say, I was taking the classes and volunteering at Junior Blind and really enjoying that a lot. Ruth Dean, the Braille instructor over there, just took me under her wing and really showed me all the ropes. And so when they offered to hire me, I was sold. And that was, I decided what I wanted to do.
Now talk a little bit about, you know, you moving down here and the call of, you know, Junior Blind came and said, you know, we need help, or, you know, you mentioned that you were a volunteer. So how did that work out where you were able to go from volunteer to them, you know, saying, hey, we need help in the Braille room, or we need help in this area, would you want to help? And you saying yes, and, you know, money discussed and pace, you know, discussed and things like that. How did that happen, and who made it happen, and what was the final straw where you said, you know what, Junior Blind, I'm not going to be, you know, I can't work for you guys no more?
Well, it was kind of a matter of being in the right place at the right time. There were a number of things. There was one person on staff as a computer instructor who was out on medical leave. There was another part-time Braille instructor who had to leave suddenly. And so one of the other part-time Braille instructors, they moved him over to help out with the computer class, and they moved me into, it was actually an on-call position. So when they needed me, they called me. When they didn't, they didn't. So I actually did very well for a few months because several people at Junior Blind were going to get their guide dogs. And so when they were off getting a guide dog, I was working 4 or 5 days a week. And then after that, it kind of went down to when people were sick or when people wanted to go on vacation, and I kind of seemed to be getting less and less work. So it wasn't like, I need to leave here. It's like, gosh, guys, I need more hours than this, and they didn't know when they could hire me for more hours. And so when the job at Braille Institute came up where they're saying, gee, we want to hire you for 20 hours a week, even though it wasn't full-time, it was a guaranteed amount of hours as opposed to just being on call. So even though it's a lot farther away, I live about, I don't know, 7 or 8 miles from Junior Blind, and I'm 34 miles from Braille, so it's a long access ride down there every day. But it was the right decision. I got the regular job, knew what my hours were going to be every day, and I'm still there.
Mm-hmm. When you got to Braille, was the Braille position automatically offered to you as well as the access technology specialist, or how did that come about? Did you get one after you got the other, or how did
I actually didn't get the access technology job until 2008. I was hired on as a part-time Braille instructor. That was the advertised job that they were looking for, and I went down and interviewed with the Director of Adult Student Services, and then I was called back for a second interview by the director and the assistant director of the regional director and assistant regional director. And then they called me back a third time and they said, gee, as part of the interview process, we'd like you to come in and teach the class. And as you might imagine, that was pretty scary. But I went down there and gave it my best shot, and they called me back 3 or 4 days later and said, we'd like to hire you. So that's how I started teaching Braille. The Access Technology Specialist position was a full-time position, and actually, after I had been there teaching Braille for, I guess, about 6 months, that position became available, and I applied for it. But at the time, they said, this position requires a driver's license, because at the time, the individual who had that job went out and worked with teachers of the visually impaired and students at various campuses. One of the things that I do in my job currently is we have a loaner program where we loan out Braille notes to middle and high school kids whose school districts won't buy them for them and whose parents can't afford them. LAUSD, you're very lucky going to school because every blind kid gets a Braille note, but that's not the case in many other school districts. So I applied for the job and they said, no, you can't have it. You gotta have a driver's license. And so I kept teaching Braille full time. And then I guess 3 years later, the position became available again, and I didn't bother applying because I figured they still want me to have a driver's license, but a full-time position came up at Junior Blind, and so I applied for that and was offered that job, and so I handed in my resignation on Friday at Braille saying, gee, I love working here, but I need to get a full-time job, so and I've asked for it, and you guys can't give it to me. And Monday morning they called back and said, gee, we've thought about restructuring this access technology. And they were going through some budget problems. That was after the recession hit and donations were down. And so they had decided maybe to make that access technology position not full time. And so they asked me if I wanted to do that 60% of the time and do the Braille instructor job 40% of the time, and they would eliminate all the driving. Teachers would have to come to us if they wanted help. I've actually had a couple people who were able to drive me around to different places if I absolutely had to get someplace. Also, I've taken OCTA or even Orange County Access, but mostly I work now out of Braille. They've sort of restructured the job. And so, yeah, I was hired to do Braille and then ended up with Access Technology. I've got two different bosses for each position, but, you know, we all get along great, and I pretty much teach Braille in the morning and do the technology stuff in the afternoon, and it makes life very interesting. I just get to do a lot of different things, and every day is different.
Okay. Well, right now that you're at Braille, where do you see yourself in the next, say, 5 to 10 years? Do you see yourself getting a new job somewhere else? Do you see yourself moving? Do you see yourself staying at Braille? Do you see yourself, getting a different job, maybe in a dispatcher or something of that sort? Or what do you see yourself?
No, I have absolutely no desire to be a dispatcher. I would do that if I had to, you know, put food on the table and you know, pay my mortgage and all that kind of good stuff. But no, I'm very, very happy at Braille, and I intend to stay there as long as I can. Now, they are moving to Irvine at some point, and that's sort of unsure as to when that's going to happen. They're having to raise some money to build a facility down there and then make the move. And when they go to Irvine, I'm going to need to make a decision as to whether I want to move down there or find another job. And to be perfectly honest with you, I haven't made that decision yet. I mean, I love living in Culver City where I live, and I love working at Braille, but Culver City to Irvine is just too much of a, I couldn't do that every day, so I'll need to make a decision as to what I need to do at that point. And frankly, I haven't made the decision yet, so, you know, when we actually get a move date for when we're moving down to Irvine, then I'll need to decide if I want to move or if I want to try and find another job. But no, I love doing what I'm doing. Teaching is great. They're very supportive of everything I do down there. I get a lot of support from my coworkers and my supervisors. And, you know, not getting rich. Nobody gets rich working in a nonprofit, but I'm comfortable and able to enjoy life. And so I'm very happy what I'm doing.
Now, why don't you talk about a little bit about how we met.
Like I say, I was downsized or let go or fired, or however you want to call it, from Cumulus. And I, you know, I'd met Kathy several years ago, and we knew we wanted to be together. We were actually married. We'd gotten married 6 months ago, and knowing, hoping we'd live in the same city at some point, but not knowing exactly when that would happen. I didn't want to quit my job in Santa Barbara and just move down here, because Franklin didn't want to be an unemployed 45-year-old blind guy. But when I was downsized, I had no choice, so I came down. And so I was frankly looking for stuff to do. I mean, I was filling out resumes and applying for jobs and taking classes, and I think by the time I met you, I was actually working at Junior Blind. But when I was volunteering there, I don't remember, someone told me about the Fulfillment Fund, and I frankly can't remember where I first heard about it, but it was an organization that pairs middle and high school kids with adults who can help them out, and they had a part of that program for kids with disabilities. And I thought, this really sounds cool, because I know when I was a kid, I really valued, my parents made an effort for me to meet as many blind adults as they could find, and I always enjoyed finding out how they did things. So I thought, gee, if I can sort of do the same thing for somebody, that would be great. And so I applied for the program, had to go through an interview process and get fingerprinted and, you know, checked out by the police and a drug test and make sure that I'm not a bad guy. And when they finally accepted me, then they said they would match me with a student, and had a worker who worked with me, and she finally called up one day and says, we have a student we'd like you to meet. His name is Joseph Fernandez, and, you know, meet him, blah, 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 blah. And so I went over there and met you and your dad, and we got to know each other in conversation or so, and then started, you know, talking on the phone a lot and hanging out once in a while, going places, and just, you know, going out for lunch or going to movies or doing whatever. And the rest is history. I, you know, since I'm working full time, I don't have as much time to spend on other activities besides work as I'd like to, but we still managed to stay in touch even after you got out of high school, and that's been a great relationship.
Now talk about how it was, you know, as a blind person, and how, you know, marriage was, and you know, you guys, I'm sure, did, you know, went out, did errands, went to movies, went out to, you know, restaurants or bars, or, you know, the reason I want you to talk about this is because what if there's a blind kid, you know, younger than you and younger than me, who wonders, you know, sure, you know, I wonder, is, you know, marriage for blind people? Well, you know, sure it is. I'm in a relationship. And, you know, you're in a relationship, you're now widowed, but, you know, I can say it, but I think if you say it as well, they will believe, like, oh, it is possible for a blind person to be with a sighted person. I mean, you know, the more people that say that, I'm sure they'll believe it. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think really it comes down to, you have to believe in yourself as a person who is blind, and you have to understand what you can do, and that you can do a lot of the same things that most other folks do. You just may do them in a different way. And over the years, I've been in many relationships, and it's always been a situation, even with just friendships, not, you know, leaving aside girlfriend, boyfriend, fiance, you know, husband, wife, whatever. You just have to know as a person how you can get through life, and then convince other people you can do that. I was very, very lucky when I met Kathy. I was not the first blind person she had met. Actually, one of the guys, the two people that sort of introduced us were both blind, and one of them was a good friend and neighbor of hers, and another was an acquaintance of hers who was a good friend of mine. And so I had it really easy. I didn't have to prove to Kathy that I could be a credible person as a blind person, because she'd met other blind people. So I was very lucky in that regard. But I think really what it comes down to is just you find different ways to get around your disabilities. And obviously, for me, not being able to drive, that was a huge situation. And Kathy had her own disability. She had multiple sclerosis, which involved a lot of things. But one of them was that she cannot drive long distances. She can't drive freeways. So she couldn't drive to me, I couldn't drive to her. So we kept Greyhound and Amtrak and the Santa Barbara Airbus, which is a service that goes from Santa Barbara to the LA airport. And we live, you know, 10 miles from the airport, so we use that a lot. And yeah, it's different things. I mean, I was online, so, you know, she could send me emails, but she couldn't write me letters. And I knew that, you know, she had her limitations, and we just wanted to live with each other's limitations and understand each other's capabilities. And I think I was perhaps luckier than most, because even though Kathy doesn't have my disability, she had her own disability, so she was familiar with how it works to convince other people of what you can do and then find workarounds for what you can't do. And plus, she'd met other blind people before, so I had it pretty easy in that regard. But for, you know, any kind of relationship, it just comes down to being able to be confident in yourself, getting those skill sets, whatever you need to learn, and then convincing the other person in the relationship, not convincing, I guess isn't the right word, but showing them that, yes, I can do this, no, I can't do that, but I can do it this way.
And was, when you guys, you know, moved in together, what finally said, hey, you know what, this one's the one? Was it the fact that she understood you and she understood that you were disabled and she herself was disabled? Or was it the fact that you guys, you know, liked a lot of the same stuff? Or what finally said, you know what, this one's the one, I'm going to put the ring on her finger?
You know what, I think we had an unusual way we got together. Our two friends who were trying to get us to know each other were, you know, they knew that she was single and that, you know, I had been married previously in the 80s and got divorced in, I guess, 89. And so I've been single for 8 or 9 years. And they said, you gotta meet Kathy, to me. And they said to Kathy, you gotta meet Steve. And so we sent emails back and forth a couple times. And I was frankly not really interested in getting into a relationship. I didn't know what my future. By then I was getting kind of tired of radio and didn't know if I wanted to move or change careers, or and the last thing I wanted to deal with was getting into a relationship. And so to get my friends off my back and so forth, we finally said, okay, let's talk. And I figured out, okay, I'll give her a call and we'll talk for 10 minutes and then I'll get these guys off my back and I can go along with my life. And the 10-minute conversation turned into, I think, 5 or 6 hours, and then we took a break for dinner and came back and talked for 3 or 4 more hours, and gosh, what was it? I mean, yeah, we liked a lot of the same things. She was, we were both really into folk music. We'd both been very heavily into Democratic Party politics, working on different campaigns. We were both obviously very interested in disability rights. She far more than me. She actually has been very involved with a lot of activities, getting rights for people. She was very instrumental in getting much of Culver City accessible to folks in wheelchairs, curb cuts, and even, you know, ramps put in at City Hall and various city buildings. She had worked in radio before she retired, actually in radio advertising. She'd done a little bit of work behind the mic in Des Moines, Iowa, where she grew up, actually in behind the mic on the radio and for a short time behind the in front of the camera on a TV station. But she got into advertising, and I, of course, had been on the air all my working life, and so we had a lot in common with radio. And just, you know, our values were very, very similar. We felt the same way about, you know, morals and religion, and it was an amazing situation that I, you know, other people have told me this happened, and I used to say, oh no, that can never happen, love at first sight, that just never happens that way. But I knew 10 minutes after I started talking to Kathy that this is the woman I wanted to spend the rest of my life with, or at least it was, you know, something I wanted to do. I didn't know if it would actually happen or not. And so a week later, after that first conversation, I came down and met her for the first time. And like I say, I didn't want to quit my job because I didn't want to be unemployed at my age and knowing it's hard for a blind person to find a job. But I think we missed, in 4 years of living in separate cities, I think 3 weekends. Every other weekend we spent together, either she came up to Santa Barbara or I came down to Culver City, or and we did the same for vacations and holidays, and so it was just a matter of, you know, so I guess the commitment came before the moving in part, even though I sort of semi-moved in because we were staying either her at my place or me at her place every weekend, and then the actual moving in came when I lost my job and moved down here.
Okay. Well, I would like to thank you, Steve, for once again coming on the podcast. The podcast is called Technology for Blind People. If people want to get in touch with you, is that okay with you? Say if another blind person who's, you know, in his junior high school years or high school years wants to get in the radio, has any questions about it, can they get in touch with you? Is that okay with you? And how do they get in touch with you?
Oh, certainly. And I got to stress that my experience with radio is now 10 years old. I have some friends that work in radio, so I know I sort of keep in touch with what's going on, but I'm not the guy to talk about the latest and greatest, but I'm happy to talk to anybody. Probably the easiest way to get the whole thing is to by email. I am at Steve Bauer, S-T-E-V-E-B-A-U-E-R, at S-A-Mobile, that's S-A-M-O-B-I-L-E.net. So Steve Bauer at S-A-Mobile.net. And that is probably the easiest way to get a hold of me, Monday through Friday. During work hours, you can reach me at Braille Institute in Anaheim, and the phone number there is 714-821-5000. My extension is 1218. Again, 714-821-5000, extension 1218, or Steve Bauer at samobile.net.
I'd really like to thank you for taking the time out to allow me to interview you, Steve. You did a wonderful job in answering all of my questions. I hope they weren't too tough. Coming on to the interview myself, I was thinking, oh no, I don't know if he's going to be able to answer every single question. It might be too tough for him, but I would really, really like to thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes edition number 2 for 2013, December 29th, Sunday. I hope you all have had a wonderful, wonderful 2013. And I hope you all have a wonderful, wonderful 2014. I look forward to hearing back any type of feedback you guys have. I'm at Gmail. My email address is dj.vision20@gmail.com. Once again, that's dj.vision20@gmail.com. Thank you very much. I hope you all have enjoyed edition 1 and edition 2. There are very many more editions to come in 2014. So please stay tuned. I'm Joseph Hernandez. Thank you.